Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Deadline's New Hollywood Podcast. My name is Dino Ray Ramos.
And I'm Amanda Nduka. So this is our first recorded guest podcast of the year. And Dino, tell them who we have.
We have One Night in Miami star Kingsley Ben-Adir, aka The King.
he plays Malcolm X in this Regina King directed film, you guys.
It's on Amazon, guys, so you have no excuse.
Unless you don't have Amazon, but I don't think, are there people that don't have Amazon in this world?
There are, because they didn't like Jeff Bezos, but he stepped down, so.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And also, if you don't have Amazon, one of your friends does.
Yeah.
So just steal their account and watch One Night in Miami. We have Kingsley Ben-Adir. It was like such a good conversation. And I love it when our guests have accents.
It just makes us sound more interesting.
It makes us sound like trash, and they're all classy.
But no, this was, I mean, you guys, he had a great year. I mean, in terms of, this man had like four projects out last year. Love Life on HBO Max with Anna Kendrick,
yes.
Yeah, Anna Kendrick, yeah. And then he had the Kami Ru, which he played Barack Obama. He did High Fidelity for Hulu.
He's like on One Night in Miami, which is like a huge award season contender. Up
today, the movie got nominated for a SAG Award.
Regina King was nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Director.
Supporting, right? Yeah, I believe supporting.
Yeah.
But the film is obviously getting a lot of buzz. It's gonna keep getting buzz. Kingsley is great. He kills this role. He gives you this different side of Malcolm X, a more softer side, which was very
softer side of Sears. Yeah.
And it was very like touching to watch. I liked seeing the camaraderie between these guys. Like you said, they had this nice like this nice romance thing going on, and it's cool seeing like iconic figure, like just imagining like iconic figures just all being friends.
It's like, kind of like that, you know, what we ask this question to our guests sometimes about, like, oh, who would you invite to a dinner party kind of thing. Like it's like these four icons came together. It's like and apparently they did have a conversation in real life in this hotel room. But no one knows what they talked about.
But this is a hypothetical
situation.
Yeah. So it's nice to kind of get this, like I said, it's like a depiction of it.
But yeah, Kingsley is dope. He's, you know what? I wish we would have talked to him more about this, but we talked about raving.
He's a raver guy. I don't even know if that's the right term.
but I mean, like, I wouldn't know. Like, well, of course I wouldn't know, but but that is towards the end. Sorry, guys, spoiler alert. Yeah. Towards the end of the podcast, we're talking about raving. But Kingsley's dope. I only expect even more from him. So I hope. Yeah.
I definitely think we're going to be seeing a lot more of him in the future. I'll put money on it. Without further ado, here is Kingsley. Kingsley, thank you so much for joining us today. You're our first guest for 2021, I believe. Yeah, because we did Javicia.
Yeah,
December.
Javicia was our first episode, but hers in December.
You're our first recording, our first guest recording.
For 2021.
Yeah. I'm so glad to be here and just...
We're happy.
My energy's raised just from looking at you, just from having content.
Wait, what time is it in London right now?
It's 7:20.
Okay, so you guys are in the time.
Yeah.
Well thank you for letting us take over your dinner time, I guess. So you've had a pretty great year, I guess 2020, like in addition to One Night in Miami, which is doing great. Congratulations on the SAG Award that we just found out today. But you had Love Life that came out, which I absolutely loved, High Fidelity, another one that I absolutely loved. I'm not just saying that, but these are like two of my favorite shows that I was watching over the quarantine. And the Kami Rule, which was on show. So you've had a pretty nice, would you say?
You've been going through it.
Yes.
2020 was awesome, man. I like just hearing you say it. Yeah, I went to. I feel like I went to New York in January, and I didn't come back until August, and had like the best time of my life shooting High Fidelity. And actually, I was in the photograph as well. I did like
in the photograph. Yeah.
You were just in everything.
No, I was out of the movie. So, which was a bit of a shame, but I still had the experience of being on the job, and then came back and did Soulmates and Love Life, and then straight into the Comey Room One Night in Miami. So it was pretty, I've never had a year like that.
You know? pretty cool. And you got to work with some really cool people. So before we get into One Night in Miami, which, you know, we'll talk about that later. We kind of like to ask our guests on our podcast, like to ask them like where they get their start from and how they sort of wound up in this crazy business. So where would you say your origin or your love for performing originated from?
I think when I was around 16, I think around 2003, I had my first experiences, you know. Really, my first experience of movies having a really like powerfully emotional effect on me. One film in particular in America, I just remember being really like confused and stunned by like the impact that some of these films and stuff were having on me. And I guess the seed was probably planted there on some level. Mm. And then, I was just like, I did drama at school, but I think when I was around 21, 22, I was sort of became aware of a drama school system here as a route in. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I can't pin it down to like a specific moment, but I think it was just over a number of years. I was just being, you know, drawn more and more drawn towards, you know, film in particular. And there was a moment where I thought about going to film school, maybe to do directing. Mm. But, you know, I was just really interested in movies, independent movies.
Were there people that you looked up to during the early days, or was there somebody that you wanted to sort of model your career path after?
Oh, so many. I feel like I watched every episode of Inside the Actor's Studio at least two or three times. You know, I studied Benicio del Toro's words and Tony Hopkins, and, you know, Jeffrey Wright is a huge hero of mine. I've studied his body of work, and like, I just, Jeffrey's really a big one for me. Just his, everything he does just has this deep, deep kind of sense of truth and integrity and just, yeah, there's just something really wonderful and magnetic about him. So Jeffrey, Viggo Mortensen, and Jim Sheridan had a big effect on me. Yeah. In the Name of the Father and in America. Mm-hmm. So yeah, loads. I mean, the list just goes on. There's like so many. Pete Popperway, it was a big one for me. You know, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some good ones, some good names.
Yeah, was there a particular movie that kind of you were just, when you watched it for the first time, you were all, oh my God, this is me, this is what I want to do?
I think
like a movie or play even, yeah?
Yeah, I think there's so many. I say in America because I think it was the first one. Mm-hmm. In America was the first, it's my first memory of being in a movie theater and having a really emotional response at the end of Paddy Considine when he's saying goodbye to Frankie. It really shook me and has stayed with me. And I've watched that film so many times since. So I think that was the first. And since then, there's all the time, you know, every few years there'll be another one. I feel like this year, Mads Mikkelsen in Another Round just blew me away. I've seen that movie three times, and there's just something about whatever's going on in that performance or in that film, they're accessing part of the magic, you know. I don't know what's going on, but I found that film so inspirational. I was like, that's why I got into this, for stories like that and performances like that. It's just when the dance at the end, I was just like, it really blew me away and left me speechless. So I think the reason why I got into acting was because of, you know, having having similar experiences when I was young. It's been really confused by it, you know, and that's not what was happening to me. Yeah. You know.
I love me some Mads Mikkelsen, though. Love him. You have a history in the theater world, right? And in film and TV. Like, how do you kind of navigate? Like, did you get your start more in the theater world, or would you say that, or would you be more like, just how was it like from going from, I guess, from like drama school to going, being thrown into the business, and how did you navigate that and kind of making that transition?
Yeah, I look back and I'm like, oh my, I can't believe I'm still here after 10 years, you know? I feel like I've been just by the skin of my teeth getting every time a job ends, I feel like I'm just about getting the next one. And I've sort of never been in that situation where I've just had so many offers or loads of things to choose from. I think I ended up doing, you know, 9 plays back to back when I first came out of drama school, because they were just the jobs that I got, you know, they were just the jobs that I was able to book. And I couldn't get a gig on TV to save my life. Like, I could not get arrested over here on film and TV. It's just was I found it really difficult. And then I, you know, with plays, you have to stop. You have to go like, right, if you want to get a TV job, you have to be available. And plays take you out of the game for like, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7 months sometimes. So there was a moment where I made that decision and decided that I was going to sort of not go on stage for a while to try and have a go at TV and film. And then I remember getting a small part in Trespass Against Us with Michael Fassbender, and that just blew my mind. That was my first experience of being on a set that I dreamed of, you know, like an independent movie about a world that we hadn't seen before on screen, and getting to watch Michael and Brendan working, you know, and just seeing how they put it all together. So that was kind of awesome. But, you know, I feel like there's been so many different parts of the journey. And I have a wonderful teacher now who I've been working with for the last 4 years. I thought drama school was a strange place. I'm very suspicious of those institutions. There were lots of individual teachers who were, you know, wonderful at different times, but I don't feel like I learned much about acting there. It was more, you know, the experience, very technical, classical. I'm still very confused by the experience that I had there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, 4 years ago, I met a wonderful, wonderful acting teacher in LA, and have kind of retrained, I guess, you know, like around the time when I got the OA. And I feel like he's really blown my mind and just opened up a whole new world for me, just in terms of interpreting character and story and creating backs. He's just given me a new way to look at it and to go in and to approach and to build characters. So I owe so much to him, and I kind of feel like the journey's just beginning, really. And learning's a funny thing, because it doesn't stop. It keeps going.
Speaking of that, you know, going from, you know, theater to TV to film, and from the start of your career to now, how have you learned to manage your expectations from this industry, which is always changing and always kind of wanting something different from you? And like, how do you just even attempt to navigate how it puts you through this ringer and plays with your emotions, basically?
Yeah, I think you got to be a little bit tough, you know?
Yeah.
Or you got to be a little bit crazy.
both.
Yeah. Sometimes I think to myself, I must be nuts to put myself through this, you know, just the highs and the lows and the rejections and the fighting for jobs and the screen testing and the auditioning and getting onto the list for the last 3 and then losing out and then getting, it doesn't stop.
Yeah. And then also like being a person of color, right? Does that add an extra layer to everything?
Yeah, but I suppose that as a way of coping, I guess as a way of coping, you I don't know. It's strange because you just because you have to just get on with it so much of the time. There are moments where you take a pause and you reflect and you go, oh, I wonder what that was. Or, you know, it's hard to summarize that into one idea, because I think it shows itself in so many different, you know, shapes and forms and sizes. And, you know, there have been some times where it's helped and got me in places. So it's difficult to pin it down. Mm-hmm. But yeah, listen, I spoke to the head of the drama school, the new head of the drama school where I trained, and the first year who are there now, over 50% of the students in the first year are non-white and from all different places.
Nice.
It's a revolutionary year, considering when I was there, you know, if you got one or two black guys in the year, you'd be lucky. And now I feel like that old system is being fucking flushed out, and it's about time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, listen, my experience when I was coming out was my experience, and, you know, you just had to get along and make the best of it in the way that I could. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But do you see, like, I mean, you mentioned that you've been doing this for 10 years now. Have you seen a meaningful change in the landscape of Hollywood when it comes to, you know, I mean, Dino mentioned it yesterday about the Golden Globe, or just now about the Golden Globes coming out, and, you know, how they've had issues with inclusion and diversity when it comes to nominees. But have you seen sort of a meaningful change in just the business as a whole when it comes to the treatment of Black people or people of color? Have you seen that change substantially since you started? Or, I mean, obviously there's still more work to be done, but how do you
see I certainly wouldn't use the word substantially.
Yeah.
Incremental, maybe, yes, of course. Oh, yeah. There's been progress, and I was talking to a younger guy, 20, maybe 8 or 9 years younger than me, similar complexion, similar background, coming out of a top drama school now in London, and his opportunities feel vastly, vastly different to mine. But that's just, you know, this year, I don't know, it's about long term, isn't it? It's long term goals, and we want to be having a conversation in 10 years and still be on the front foot and moving forwards. And, you know, I kind of don't want to get too overly optimistic, because I feel like I don't want to let anyone off the hook. I think we have to keep fucking pushing for representation in all areas, you know, like, our business is at the forefront of that conversation, because, you know, we're supposedly artists and about, you know, change and story and truth and humanity and love and connection, and, you know, that's the world that we're in. That's the profession that we've chosen. Mm-hmm. So yeah, and then the whole business side of things and awards and stuff, that's something that I have no idea about.
Who knows where to even begin to start when it comes to stuff like that and institutions that determine who get, anyways.
That, yeah, we could have a whole other hour conversation about that.
But we want to obviously talk about One Night in Miami, which was just, you know, everything that you would want in a, like, it was so, such a, so refreshing. Something was so refreshing about it, and seeing these men gathered together and just, like, you know, talking out, sharing their issues, but also, like, having this, like, really nice, this nice bonding moment. It just had everything, I feel like, that we don't get to see a lot, especially when it comes to portraying Black men. And it was just done so well. So first I want to ask you, were you familiar with Kent Powers' play before you signed on to do this project? Because I wasn't. I had no idea about this play until this film.
Yeah, I did. I remember when it was cast in here.
Okay. Mm. So what were your initial thoughts about it when this first came across to you, this project?
The movie?
Yes, the movie.
Well, I was so excited and curious to connect with Regina King. I was like, that was awesome. think that was my first, that was my first thought before I thought about any of the characters, or before I was like, oh wow, Regina King's directing a movie, that's nuts. Like, what an awesome opportunity to get to maybe audition, so she, and she might see it. And it came in for cash, and I felt just too old and washed up for that.
Oh really?
I just felt too old. I felt I was doing High Fidelity and I was playing Mac. He was a bit older, and I just was like, I can't play this kid. I can't. You know, I could play. I'm pushing it. You know, mid to late 20s now, max. But I can't play a bubbly 21-year-old. So I passed on the audition. But I said, if Malcolm, if anything happens to the actor playing Malcolm, let me know. I'd love to swoop in and audition for that part. You know, Malcolm was really the character that spoke to me. Mm-hmm. The conversation between him and Sam, I was like, oh, this is juicy. Like, you could get
it. Is oh god, what they unpack in that room. I'm just like, being a fly on, like the way that Regina filmed it, it's like we were just a fly on that room. Yeah. And we were just like popcorn eating, seeing what y'all were going through.
And fun to build that, you know, like when you're working on it in your room and you're just figuring out how you're going to play it, and you know, work, figuring out what Malcolm's point of view is in it and where he's at and what his, you know, just it was just a lot of fun, because so much language, like the whole film structure is really so dependent on how we build the ebbs and flows of this conversation. So as an actor you've just got so much to work with. It's just so that was awesome. Sorry, I've jumped a little bit ahead. But anyway, the audition for Malcolm did come up event like 4 or 5 months later. And then I put something down on tape, and then Regina and I jumped on the phone, and
rest is history.
Were you, I know there's like this debate about like who can play sort of what characters, and you've tackled Barack Obama in the Comey role, and then now you're playing Malcolm X. But I'm gonna ask, were you ever sort of nervous tackling these roles, especially when, you know, there are people out there that like to debate, like I said, who can play some type of role, if a black person that grew up in American playing should be playing American icon roles. Like, were you nervous about like maybe getting criticism or backlash or anything like that?
Regina asked me around the time when I was auditioning, and maybe kind of ignorantly, you know, I just had no idea. It didn't cross my mind at all. I think because of, you know, where I'm from over here, I've always felt so connected to, you know, African-American culture has been such a huge part of my upbringing, and the first sort of role models I ever had were African-American. So I think we're kind of, you know, naively, and I remember saying to Regina, just that I'm not thinking about that. You know, I've got, you know, if you give me the job, there's work to do, and this is what I'm going to do, and I want to honor Malcolm, and I'm going to put my life and body and soul into this, and I'm going to do everything I can. And it really just didn't occur to me. And it was only, I was sort of aware that, you know, there was a conversation that had been happening, but I was just pure drive and arrogance, really. I remember Regina asking me, and I was like, nah man, I've just got work to do, you know.
And you know, I've always felt very, I mean, when it comes to that debate, I've always felt very like, I've seen so many, like I loved David Oyelowo playing Martin Luther King. I just watched Judas and the Black Messiah the other day.
Oh God, yes.
Daniel killed that role. Like, he bodied that role. It's like, to me, it's like, if you're willing to put in the work and do the research, and like you said, like,
if you have the chops, then why not?
Yeah. So it's, I don't know. I get, go ahead.
No, I'll say as well, though, that was my answer to my, when I first got the role. Mm-hmm. Now I'm sort of understanding that in a larger sense, the conversation is kind of unpacking as we talk. And it's something that representation and who gets to play who in so many areas, not just African-American roles, it's something we don't know. We're figuring it out, you know? So I'm listening. And my honest opinion is that as well, you have to take each casting process as its own thing. And, you know, Regina had 3.5 weeks to cast. There were, you know, a number of people who didn't want to audition for the role. And like, it came down to me and another guy who were available, and I just had a bit more experience than him. You know, it really wasn't, it was a very, very last minute bit of casting. So like, when I talk about me being cast as Malcolm, I want to be clear as I can about the stakes and the pressure and the time restrictions that we were under. You know, and when I got the role, I had 12 days to prepare. So there was a time where I was like, I don't know if I can do this. You know, I don't know if I can actually honestly prepare Malcolm X in 12 days and feel good about it. And
that is amazing.
But yeah, I went for a walk and I was like, I feel like I have to do this because I feel like I feel like this is an opportunity to show Malcolm in a really different way. And the vulnerability and the humanity, it was really something I connected with. And I felt very, very confident about, you know, persuading Regina to let me do it. Because I was like, I want to do something different with this, you know, and I think it's about time. And so, yeah, I tricked her into giving me.
Well, you did. I mean, you did great. You did great as Obama, too. Like, it is definitely a conversation that I think that we are definitely unpacking now. But it's very complex. But
there's so much. Yeah.
They're great. They've been great, you know. Non-American actors performing in these roles, and they've killed it, you know.
Yeah, so. I think the conversation is so nuanced when it comes to, you know, representation. Like, for instance, with the trans community, right? You know, if you're getting someone like Jared Leto playing someone trans, and that kind of complicates a lot of things, and people are going to automatically cause an uproar. But then you have something like that new movie that came out last week, Supernova, with Colin Firth and Stanley Tucci. I don't know if they identify as queer, but I don't think they identify as queer, but they're a gay couple. But I think it's so interesting because that movie is less about them being gay and more about this guy going through dementia and deteriorating, this relationship falling apart. So it's like also the way you look at it, right? Yeah. And but I think I can't speak in terms of like Black, non-American Black actors playing American icons, you know, people really get, you know, in their panties about it. And I'm just like, oh, dude, if they're good, then if they have it, they have it, you know? I mean, I'll drag a performance if it's horrible, but if they're good, then they're good. but, you know, playing Malcolm X, you know, when I read Malcolm X his autobiography, I don't want to say it changed my life, but it kind of opened my eyes to interesting things about, you know, identity and his life. And Malcolm X is a huge order. That's a tall order. And, you know, we've seen him portrayed in different forms of media before, but, you know, where did you start, you know, knowing, well, not only is he a real person, but you're also playing, I guess, a hypothetical version of him in this conversation that we don't know what happened, but what was your process in just navigating playing this very powerful icon and kind of, I would guess, demanding role?
Well, I think the first thing is you look at the film and you look at, you look at the story. So you look at the script and you go, who is Malcolm in this story? What is the Malcolm that Kemp is asking for in this story? What does this film require from the character of Malcolm X? What is Malcolm's function within this piece? Mm-hmm. And really, for me, the stakes for what was going on for him at the time, and the monumental shifts and changes, like, it's a really, really, really specific, like, moment for him in terms of the changes and what was about to happen in a few weeks and what had just happened in the couple of months leading up for this, in terms of his, you know, his relationship with the Nation and Elijah Muhammad was really coming to an end, and the Chickens Coming Home to Roost speech was just in the November, and you know, within 2 weeks of this night, Cash and Malcolm would never speak again. And so I feel like understanding who Malcolm needed to be in this story and deciding whether or not I connected with that in a way that felt truthful. Mm-hmm. Was something that I learned more and more as I was going along. Mm. And the more I started to investigate what was happening for Malcolm at this time and the changes that were going on, the more Kemp's script just was becoming clearer and clearer and clearer and clearer about what I needed to do. And the stakes for Malcolm in this movie were about trying to keep Cash in the room and needing to connect with these men and feeling in a moment, you know, kind of lost and unsure in how dangerous it was for him at this time. And I guess I stayed in as much of a zone as possible, just listening and repeating and watching and listening and repeating. But the stuff that I found out about Malcolm through Dick Gregory and his friendship with him and who Malcolm was in private, outside of the media cameras, and the way that Dick described him as being, you know, a wonderful father and husband and a sweet man and a kind man, a bashful man, a good-humored man, someone who, you know, from the lacerating demagogue from the archive footage was really a character that Malcolm slipped into but wasn't the sum total of who he was. Like, that was the stuff I really held on to. And and there's an understanding. Malcolm said to Dick at this time that he felt weak, and this is a quote, and he felt weak, he felt hollow, and no one knew the torments that he went through around this time. And I just was like, you know, that I really held on to that. And thought, you know, the reason why Malcolm is a hero is because he felt the fear and he still faced it, you know. He felt the fear and he still demanded that white America take a hard look at themselves. And, you know, he was crying inside for black people, you know. He had the weight of the world on his shoulders. And I think, above all, I am convinced anyway, all the militancy and the, you know, the white people are dealt, all that nonsense. I'm convinced that Malcolm, above all, was a deeply, had to have been a deeply, deeply, deeply sensitive human being, and a deeply intelligent human being, and a deeply religious man, and a deeply spiritual human being. And that just interested me so much, because I was like, I don't feel like we've seen that before. And and so I was all in, and I expressed that to Regina. Where my fearlessness came from to believe that, I don't really know. I just think it was a bit of timing, and I was just in the right place, the right age, the right moment in my jobbing actor career, where I was just like, I'm ready to take a risk. I've got nothing to lose.
I love what you said about, you know, kind of showing this softer side, I guess you would say, more sensitive side of Malcolm X, because we see these activists and radicals, and I guess you could even say it would happen in Judas and the Black Messiah too, with Chairman Fred Hampton, you know, these charismatic, like passionate people who have a stance on something. We never really get to see that other side of that human side of them. Mm-hmm. And I think in One Night in Miami, we got to see him as a friend, as a homie, with like his homies just hanging out. And they argue like friends. And, you know, going to that, you know, with one of the main things that stood out for me is this, the conversation you have, or Malcolm X has with Sam, about being a performer and, you know, the black identity and kind of like white people co-opting it and all that, this whole complicated conversation. Did doing this movie and having conversations like that challenge or support your own views when it came to identity politics within the world of entertainment or film and TV?
Identity politics, or you mean the role of the artist and what their responsibility is, or what do you mean?
Yeah, and just like being a black man, and you know, kind of, I don't want to say, I guess I don't want to say, like, kind of putting on a show for white people, that kind of
I'm tired of that, man. I can't, you know, I was coming out of drama school at a time where they were genuinely teaching us to change the way that we spoke, you know, like we were being trained to go, and I'm saying this in fucking 2011, this is not even long ago.
Wow. Oh, wow.
Training us to go in to get jobs at the National Theatre and the RSC and, you know, Cheek by Jowl and all these like posh theatre companies. I could not, there's nothing about any of them that I ever had any interest in working with. And I feel like I've spent the last 10 years trying to shake off so much of that and like just talk how I talk. Do you know what I mean? Like we're artists, man. We're like, we're creating stories. I don't understand that there's this pressure over here. And I guess in some ways in America, I you know, it's less clear in the way that I speak, like what my class is, you know, and I feel like there's something about New York, you know, that I feel so at home there and I feel so connected when I'm there. And, you know, I guess it's tricky because we're in different places and my experience has very much been about trying to get away from the bullshit theater system that exists here, you know, and like the classism that goes on and that was going on when I was at drama school. It's something that has always made me feel, I've always desperately just wanted to get away from it, you know? So I can only speak from my experience in that way through coming up through the system here. I don't know.
I think whether it be in film and TV actors or filmmakers, I think a lot of people in the margins, you know, underrepresented voices, the LGBTQ community, even the disabled community, I always say there's a certain generation. I'm part of that bastardized generation between X and millennial, Gen X and millennial. And, you know, we always taught to put our head down, don't cause a ruckus, don't ruffle feathers, and in a way bend over backwards to make people feel comfortable around you. And I feel like I've been, I want to say even like this past or like throughout my career, or you know, I'm speaking, you know, about me, sorry.
Please.
I felt like I've been trying to unlearn all of that, you know.
Like, how old are you, if you don't mind me asking? Is that private?
I'm 41.
I thought you was like 27 or
20. Well, no. I'm 41. It's Asian, don't raisin, right? I feel like it's the same with a lot of us. You know, we're taught a certain thing. A lot of us in the margins, at least, we're taught to make people feel comfortable around us so we could please them, and we never get to live our true selves sometimes. And I think that's why I'm jealous more of this younger generation, because they're a little bit more fearless.
It's a lot more encouraged now. Like, it's like, especially being a female, it's like, you know, always be on your behavior, be on your P's and Q's. And now it's like, you know, the most, like, do the most whatever thing you can do, and that's who's like getting them. It's different now. But so hopefully, like, we're all sort of, because I know I'm still unlearning that sort of trait too. So I know a lot of us are still learning that. That's why the conversation between Sam and Malcolm was very interesting.
Yeah, that's why I love. I'm like, oh, okay, they're having this conversation, I just love that moment.
I'm
just
having that conversation today. Yeah. So,
and it can't. And honestly, I don't think that conversation can be encapsulated just in a movie scene. It goes beyond that. It's just like identity politics. I'm beginning to hate that term more and more. But it's a thing, you know, that a lot of us have to kind of, it's hurdles we have to jump over. And I made this like comment the other day, or like a while back, where it's like it's easy for people of color and people in the margins to, you know, adhere to this rule of wearing a mask because we're used to making people uncomfortable. Because if you look at all the people who are complaining about wearing masks, most of them are white. But that's I'm not gonna say anything. But
you're gonna get me in trouble.
I'll get in trouble for you, Kingsley. So.
So Kingsley, what's next for you that you can tell us, or if you can't tell us, is there something that you haven't done yet, a role that you haven't tackled yet that you would like to tackle next?
You know what? I'll be super honest with you. I feel like the moment that I am in personally, in terms of like career or work, it's happening now rather than something to look for. Do you know what I'm saying? It's like the material that's coming in and the directors that I'm meeting and the conversations that I'm having. I'm like, oh no, this is what I've been working towards right now, today. Like when I jump off, what I'm reading, when I woke up this morning, the calls that come in. So it's kind of happening in terms of like a genre or a role. No, I have no idea. Just completely. I think the stories and characters that interest you should change with the month, with the week, with the year. It's different depending on where you are and where you're at. And I haven't been on set in nearly a year, and I don't miss it because I feel like I'm really enjoying I'm really enjoying reading so much and like looking at story in a different way and contributing to scripts and development and just having conversations where I feel more involved creatively and have an input, and I'm actually thinking about character and all. Just so much of this job for me anyway is just, you feel like you're just treading water, man.
Yeah,
just getting a gig, like pay the rent and just save your money, and do you know what I mean? So it's like to have a handful of scripts to choose from is very, very new. It's very, very precious to me. This is a very, very like sacred moment, and so I don't feel like I'm wishing for anything in to come, because it's right.
That's such a good answer. You're living in the moment.
Yeah. It sounds really cheesy when I just heard it out loud like that, but it's true.
No, it's true. I was gonna add. I'm just curious. This has like a random question. Your name, Kingsley. Were you named after someone? Like, I think your name is so cool.
my mom wanted to call me King. But I think she had a lot of people around her saying, you can't do that. she found an in-between, Kingsley. But I was thinking about this the other day. My agent, Elaine, she calls me King. And I there's something I find so impersonal about Kingsley. Mm. Because all my friends and my family and my loved ones and people I grew up with, they call me King. Kingsley was only really the name that I started using at drama school, because I was, I've made to feel like it was not, you can't be called King. Mm. So whenever I say Kingsley, it feels like it's not my name. It's really weird.
Your mom is from Trinidad, right?
My mom's born here, born in the UK, but my grandma and granddad were from Trinidad and Tobago and came over in 50. I think my grandma came over in 1948 and my grandpa came over in 1951, and they worked in the NHS because after the war there was a huge call out to the Commonwealth and the islands to come over and to help, because the hospitals were down. Mm-hmm. My mom was born here in the 60s. Mm.
Yeah, you should just change it to King. King, that's like a flex.
I know so many people that are named Prince. I know so many people, women, that are named Queen.
Yeah, I know a few Nigerian men who are called King and Kingsley.
Yeah, there's Nigerians called Blessing. There are names like, I mean, Nigerians have like the most creative, like biblical type names, like Blessing.
Like, I don't know if
somebody's name was actually God's Grace.
Wait, okay.
I know somebody named God's Grace, yes.
I almost fell out of my chair. Sorry. Because in the Philippines, it's so funny because like the youngest boy in the family, will have a regular name, right? Like whatever. But they would always call him boy, or the youngest girl would be baby. So my dad, he's the youngest boy in his family. So his real name is Froilan, but everyone calls him Boying. So it's so weird, like how different cultures and names. I'm just really fascinated with names.
Anyway. If you want us to call you King, we'll call you King.
Yeah, we'll call you King.
We'll start referring you to King and everything, all our stories. We like to end this interview. This has been great, by the way.
Yes.
We like to end it with this little segment we call the facts or the FAQs, just sort of random questions, fun questions. So the first question is, in the movie, there's a lot of vanilla ice cream. So if you can only eat one ice cream flavor for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Oh, man. I have to say vanilla just for safety. You have to, because then if you pick the one and you get sick, you know.
Yeah.
Vanilla.
I mean, I was craving vanilla ice cream after watching
the movie. I actually love vanilla ice cream, yeah.
Because it's vanilla ice cream is a blank palette. You could add to anything.
Vanilla ice cream, you can have apple pie with that. You can apple crumb.
Chocolate sauce.
Put candy in it. Yeah, you're right.
Telling you, it's a blank canvas.
You can have a sundae with chocolate sauce and all of that.
Yeah.
Thing, you know what I mean? So
that's a good one, yeah.
Vanilla. That is a good, yeah, vanilla. I remember for the one night in Miami, they sent us these care packages with vanilla ice cream. there was like this place card that said, I don't know if Malcolm X really said it, but all we have is vanilla and vanilla.
No, that was a line. That was a line.
Yes. I don't know if he really said it, but it's like, when I read it, I was like, oh, I get it now. Like, I get the double entendre. So, okay, so besides One Night in Miami, what award season contender movie are you rooting for, or that you love, that you want to give love to?
Well, I feel like Another Round is definitely the movie that has had the biggest effect on me. I love Lakeith. I think he is. I think he's one of the most special actors that we've had in a long time. Like a long time. And I don't even mean black. I mean just actors, period. And I remember watching him in really small bits and pieces, like years and years and years ago. And I remember when I first signed with an American agent, finding out that, you know, a couple of the jobs I'd missed out had gone to this guy. And I just remember watching his work and just feeling, you know, it's hard. You're always jealous of people, you know, when you miss out on jobs and stuff. But I remember always watching Lakeith and just being so like, I'm glad he's got it, because he's going to do something real special with whatever you give him. So I guess there's so many films and performances and direction and productions that I've enjoyed. I think what Daniel did, you know, and all the boys from the cast, One Night in Miami as well. I'm rooting for everyone in Regina, but, you know, I think what Daniel achieved was astounding work. Astounding.
That movie. I mean, we've all seen it, right?
Yeah.
That one scene, there's just one scene that I bawled when couldn't.
You can't spoil the movie, David. You have to take that out.
whatever.
Okay.
We're in a pandemic.
Okay, next question. Okay, so everybody has one. What is your favorite reality TV show?
Oh no, I'm gonna sound so bad here, because I don't, you know, does it have to be now?
No,
it doesn't have to be now. Ever.
It's like a real world. Okay, or
cool. So obviously when I was like 12, 13, there was a few seasons of Big Brother that I was completely but then with the first pop idol we had here with Will Young and Gareth Gates, whatever his name was, I remember being glued to that. Like, it was, do you know what I mean? It was like, that was Saturday night. That was meant everything. But yes, I didn't really watch. I want to watch some more, because I got friends who, like, they swear by it. Like, they swear by, you know, the only way is Essex, and we got some different ones over here.
Yeah, yeah.
Just for like, just pure.
Wait, what's that one? That one that you just said, different way in Essex. What's that?
I think there's a show here called The Only Way Is Essex. I think The Only Way Is Essex.
Yeah, there's a couple of Essex reality TV shows, right? Because I feel like I've heard a different one, like maybe like Made in Essex or something.
Made in Chelsea, or is it Made in Chelsea, or one?
What are those about?
I don't know.
I think they're kind of like
a real world kind of thing.
No, not like a real world, because I don't think they live in one house. But I think it's kind of like a maybe like the hill, like the hill or something.
Oh, okay. So they. Okay. So it's just basically
the hills. Yeah, the hills.
So is it kind of like just like following pretty people around in their lives?
Pretty rich people. Yeah.
I think that's basically the long and short of it. Yeah.
Like Bling Empire. Oh God!
I watch all the reality shows, so I'm like I'm obsessed. Yeah, just because like we have to watch. So I use it for like sort of like my I don't have to think. You know, like whenever you want to have some type of mindless TV or something in the background, I always put reality TV. Like I'm a Housewives.
Amanda knows I'm a huge RuPaul's Drag Race fan.
But
Drag Race has a UK version. They're current
on the TV. I was flicking through and I keep seeing there's a show on the BBC here.
Yeah, it's BBC and it's on an app here. But they have Drag Race UK. They have Drag Race Thailand. They have Drag Race Canada. They have Drag Race Holland.
Would you recommend something? Would you recommend? Should I put it on?
Love Drag Race.
I would. You'll get invested. I'm also part of a Drag Race Fantasy League. where the winner wins $300. And so far this season, I'm in second place.
Oh, nice.
Tied for second.
Look at you.
This is my life.
Okay.
King, what was your very, very first job?
When I was 6 or 7, there was a clothes shop. There was a store at the end of my road, and my mum was young, and she was like, she knew all the guys there, and he used to let me and my brother fold up t-shirts and pack them in boxes, and he'd give us £5. he'd give us £5, to do that. Chris at Map in Kentish Town. So that was first, but he was just probably just looking up, you know what I mean? Looking after. First job, I don't know. I did like a just fucking catering and bar work and all of that stuff, just grinding, just like serving tables and,
I believe everyone should at least one time in their life be a waiter or be work in the service industry at least once in their life.
Yeah.
Just because to see how horrible people are.
I remember going, I am the worst waiter. I could never bring a smile to my face. I could never get into it. I just was a pain in the ass, you know?
Yeah.
I lost 3 days.
Oh, wow, yeah.
I was a waiter and a host. I don't know which one was worse, but.
You have to be so energized and like happy.
You have to be up all the time. Yeah. And you have to act like you care that these people eat, and I didn't.
I worked in like clothes stores.
Retail is horrible.
Retail is horrible.
Retail is horrible.
Boring. It gets really dull, right?
It's so I worked at the Gap for 7 days.
okay. So if you can live in any era in history that obviously didn't have racism or prejudice.
Like we'll take racism out of the formula.
Out of that stuff. But if you could live in any era in history, which one would it be?
I think I would like to have been the age I am now, coming to the end of the 80s and the early 90s to
experience. Ooh, good era.
To experience that rave scene, that house scene. that came to the North and was coming from Chicago, and like that feeling, that transition of music, and to have gone raving, like to have been a part of that rave culture at the beginning, I think was just a really interesting time, because I was alive, but I just don't remember it. I was like 5 or 6. But whenever I see like archive footage from like Glastonbury from around that time, or like up North, like house scenes, and there's certain house anthems, I think, that have like stuck from that time that you still play out when you go out now, they'll come on. And I guess as well, I miss New York a lot, but I do miss raving, you know, I do miss house music. And
That is such a good era.
Who's a big artist right now, like a house music artist, would you say?
I wouldn't know.
I'm not too, as much as I like to rave and like I like the music, I'm not a huge like encyclopedic knowledge. I don't have an encyclopedic knowledge of house. Disclosure, you know, a kind of a borderline mainstream production duo out of the UK who have some really, really interesting stuff. But yeah, there's a few Chicago house DJs who I've seen play out at festivals. I can't remember now, but soulful house.
Yeah, because that was like the era of like right when it was about to hit, and then it became like acquainted more with drugs and stuff down the road. But like kind of right at the top of it is when it was about the music and about, you know, the culture, and until the drugs came in.
House music still big in London?
Oh yeah.
Okay. Yeah, the one time that I spent a night in London, it was a long, long time ago. Like, I was probably still in my teens, but we went to we were going like to different clubs. I remember it was house music. All the clubs were just playing house music, and I was like, oh, okay, so I guess London is just into house
music. House music pops. Yeah. I enjoy it.
It's really,
especially during that era.
Like, it's coming out of Chicago, a lot of the really, really like the really, really cool stuff. I think the scene started in Chicago, I believe, and I think Lee Foss and Jamie Jones, I think that's their names, like big DJs coming from that side. And I remember one night before I got one night in Miami, I booked 12 tickets to see Solomon at Printworks here. And when I wrapped one night in Miami, I flew back. This is just before the lockdown. Landed, stayed up all day, and then 15, 20 of my friends came around and we all went to see Solomon and raved until like, you know,
into the
morning. And then within a few weeks, that was it. Boom, we locked down. Like, yeah.
It's rave. A good way to end it. one more question. Is there we ask this to all of our guests, is there an underrepresented voice in the industry, whether it's an actor, writer, producer, creator, that is not in the mainstream that you think people need to know about and deserve more recognition and shine?
I have a really, really good friend of mine who I think is about to blow, you know. She's just got the lead in a new show. I love her. She's a super, super talent. Her name's Rhea Zimitrovich. And we did a play together 7 or 8 years ago called God's Property at the Soho Theatre here. Renzé Kenny, a friend of mine who wrote the play. And she's just, every time I see her, she just gets better and better and better. And she has something so incredibly unique about her and vulnerable and powerful. And I think that, you know, she's taken more time, but when the world finally gets to see what she's about, it's gonna be a special day, because it's coming. But yeah, I'd say Rhea was the first person that popped to my mind. I don't know I feel a little bit sort of unsure about saying she's underrepresented. I just mean that she's coming. I don't think the state. I don't think America knows about her yet. But
what's her last name?
Rhea Zimitrovich.
Zimitrovich. Yeah, there you go. Keep that name in mind, everyone.
Kingsley, thank you so much for joining us today. This is such a great conversation.
Yes. First recording of 2021. What a way to start with a king.
Yes. Thank you for being our first guest. And congrats on the film, and best of luck with
everything.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You guys too, man. Great talking.
Yeah, hopefully we'll see you in a late 80s, early 90s rave movie.
Yeah.
Oh, that would be dope.
Yes.
I have all my moves ready.
Okay, okay, cool.
We're ready.
Yeah,
Kingsley, thank you so much.
If you lot are ever in London after this lockdown, let's go raving.
I'm down.
we're not like raver, but like after this lockdown,
I'll just go
anything. Anywhere. We just got to play
I'll go anywhere.
Staring the pop.
Right. Yeah. Thanks,
Kingsley.
I'll see you guys. Take care.
All right.
Life's better with American Family Insurance because our home policies help protect your dreams and come with peace of mind. Save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote, find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.